What does it mean for the world or the mind to enter a causal condition? It means that it goes into a state where it itself is not being experienced, but it's the same mind that comes out. Like, say, when you go to sleep, at that time, there is no experience. The mind is not active. There's no subject-object differentiation. There's no awareness of what's going on within Maya. And so that said, the mind is going into its causal condition because the same mind comes out. Say the mind goes into that condition where it's really the mental experiences are not there anymore, the vrittis are gone, and it doesn't come back out, then that's death or something. It's not like a causal condition.
So it sort of goes into a potential state.
It goes into its potential state or its material cause and then comes back out in the same.
Is that why it's called a causal condition? Because it's a material cause?
Yeah. Okay. That's good. That's right. Material cause, the only thing is with material cause, we do use the word upadana, karana, for material cause, but just don't equate material with physical matter. So the material cause of a substance that's manifest will be of the same order of reality. So if a subtle substance that's manifest, it will go back into its subtle cause. And so when we use the word material, that's kind of a Western word, and you don't think of material as subtle or gross. So it goes back into the causal condition of its own state, its own order of reality. So the mind is subtle. It's subtle. It's sattva. So it goes, it's the all five elements that are made of the sattva. So it will go back into the causal sattva, which is just prakriti. Prakriti itself, Maya itself, when we think of Maya, we're really thinking of the causal condition that then manifests as the creation, both subtle and physical. Subtle is called Hiranyagarbha from the collective perspective, and the physical is called Virat. Right? So when you're talking about Maya manifest, you would not necessarily, Maya is an all-inclusive form, but when we're just thinking of Maya itself, it's Maya in its causal condition. Even when we say Ishvara, Ishvara is Brahman with taking into account this incidental attribute that belongs to it, that is in its causal condition. Right? In that causal condition, from beginningless time comes a new manifestation and then dissolves into its causal condition.
So in that case, would the causal condition be the laws of order in the creation, Ishvara's order?
Well, for the jiva, yes, it is all Ishvara's order, but you're waking up the same person as you were when you went to sleep, with the same memories and all that. But say with the universe, which lasts for a much more longer time, and as it goes through the four the four yugas and then goes, even then it doesn't necessarily go into a completely causal condition. It's kind of complex, these kind of orders of these different types of withdrawal. There's different levels of withdrawal, but say it has the complete, goes into complete what we call pralaya, where it goes into its complete causal condition, then it is that universe then comes up afresh because it's morning time. In the middle of the night, that's called kind of Kali Yuga. In the morning time, starting at 4 in the morning, that is when you're most sattvic, you're most bright, you're most present. A lot of scholars, just a little aside, a lot of scholars, one scholar told me, you can't be a scholar unless you get up around 4 in the morning every day. Because the day's busy, there's too much to do, there's too much going on. But like from about 4 to 6 or 7, those hours are your private hours. Your mind is fresh. There's nothing happening. The atmosphere is very subtle. Mm. You know? Mm. So sometimes the four yugas are looked at as the different times in the day of Brahma. One day of Brahma is one kalpa, like that. So the morning, I believe, starts at like 4 in the morning. That's the freshest time. Everything is, nobody's tired, there's no tiredness there, it's just fresh. And the sun is shining, penetrating through this fresh sattvic morning And then the second yuga, you know, it's moving into the to the noontime and afternoon, and there's a little bit more going on. It's not as sattvic. Then the late afternoon, you're starting to get worn out. It's time to rest. And then it gets dark out. That's Kali Yuga. When it's get, that's the dark time. It's time to go to bed.
So how do we know that... You said earlier that this is not the darkest time yet. How do we know?
Well, that's a good question. There is a problem for us in determining exactly where we are in the yuga system. Most astrologers say that we're in the first quarter of Kali Yuga. Mm-hmm. Some people will say that we haven't even gone into Kali Yuga. Some will say we've gone out. But this is why even astrologers have a problem, is that we are BCAD, you know, or whatever it is now, whatever we changed it into. Mm-hmm. The common time.
CE.
Okay, the common time. That's better anyway. But nevertheless, we're kind of recent, the way that we mark time. In India, the time of the Vedas and even the Ramayana and the Mahabharata, they didn't mark time by this common era and all of that. They marked it by the astrologically. And so to give the date of something was a paragraph long, you know. And talking about just the position of all of the planets, and so I've read those times. I know how they. I don't know how to really do all of that, but I can. I've read, and Swamiji's read out what some of these times are in astrological language. But there's debate over what that time actually is, because it's going way, way back. So the calculations are. In dispute. Mm-hmm. And so we don't really know what's right.
But it is early times. It is early times.
Of Kali Yuga?
Yes. Yeah. Susan read about it and she explained it to us a long, long time ago.
Yeah, well, I think that's what most astrologers mm-hmm. believe. I'm just saying that, and you believe that, mm-hmm. a lot of astrologers believe that, and there's quite a few that don't. Believe that they think that it's either before or much later.
Seems
I'm just
that
saying
lack
that
of clarity would be a sign of it's Kali Yuga.
Yeah.
How can we be out of Kali Yuga? I guess I don't understand, because you said some scholars are thinking that we've already come out of it.
And well, that's also something I don't understand. I understand only a little tiny bit, and that is in the Kalpa system, where you go through one whole yuga and then it starts up again without a total pralaya. Not every going through the four yugas ends up in a total withdrawal into causal condition. There are books on that. I mean, even you can look at it on the internet where they're kind of explaining how long each one lasts, how many kalpas are necessary for a total withdrawal of the creation. So I don't have that all done. I haven't really studied it that carefully. I studied it enough to know that that's interesting. but not enough to teach it.
Just one thing, you said that after each Kali Yuga you do go into total withdrawal, or maybe?
Maybe. That's because there's different types of withdrawal. One is the withdrawal of the whole universe into unmanifest condition, but there's another, and I don't remember all of this, so you have to go study it yourself, but I'll just say what I think that I've read. Is that there are different what they call kalpas, and a kalpa is comprised of all four of the yugas, but there's so many kalpas that take place before there's a total pralaya.
Oh.
Now, that's what I'm saying, and I may not have it quite right.
Sure.
I think you do.
Yeah.
But there's
bigger cycles too.
Right.
Yeah.
And apparently also towards the end of Kali Yuga, you'll know, because there will be no trees on this planet, and people will be very, very small, and there's a lot of other things.
Good to know.
Have you sort of heard that also?
What I've heard is that the trees will all be very small, the people will be small, they'll all be the same color, because mixing pot. Mm. All the cultures, everything, which is happening, not that far in the future, we'll all be look like Yeah, the same race.
On material cause, did we also use that to describe
Brahman?
Brahman.
Yes. Now, when we're talking, the word is...
Is that using it in a different way?
No. No, but let me explain it. There is that if we want to kind of encompass all of reality from this Vedic vision, there is Brahman, which is just non-dual conscious being. Okay, that's called the Vivarta Upadana Karana. The Upadana Karana we translate as material cause. What we mean by material cause, if there's any name and form, if there's any type of form, what is ultimately the content of that form? What is that? The form has to have some substance. And so we would say there's no such thing as an empty form. Right? Like, say, if you have a clay pot, it depends upon the clay. And then the clay also depends upon something else, which depends on something else into an infinite regress. But the thing that which is not an infinite regress is the actual bottom line upadana material cause of the pot or of the entire creation. And that is called Vivarta Upadana Karana. Vivarta means it is the material cause, but it goes through no type of modification whatsoever to be the material cause. So that material cause is existence, which is consciousness, Satchit. And we can experience that easily, actually as the common denominator of every level of experience we have, subtle experiences, mental experiences, emotional experiences, spirit experiences born through your sense perception. No matter what experience that you're having, every one of those experiences is. So existence or being is a common denominator of every level of experience. And the knownness of the experience, it is, you don't have an experience that's not known. You're not having the experience then. So isness, being, and knownness, so sat, chit. Sat means existence, chit means consciousness. The consciousness is existence, the existence is consciousness. They're not two things. But that is the common denominator, which is never goes through any change whatsoever. It's satyam. And that satyam is the adhishtana of the projection, sustenance, and withdrawal of the world. Now, what is the upadana karana of that that brings this about? If it's mithya, but which is the mithya upadana karana, the mithya material cause that causes the manifestation of this display of duality and diversity? So we say instead of vivarta upadana karana, which is Brahman, we say the parinama upadana karana, the material cause that is responsible for the infinite array of modifications. That's parinama, means the modification. So this creation that we call mithya is maya. Maya is the maya, which is the material cause which is responsible for the display of time and space and all of the modifications that go on within time and space. See what I mean? So that's why there's two. You have to account for maya. So what is the material cause of this diversity that we experience? And then what is the material cause that gives existence to that diversity, that we call maya, that display of diversity? Maya means ya ma iti maya. That which is not, that is maya. Means it has no being of its own. It's a good definition of mithya. That it's a little tongue-in-cheek in a way, because you say that which is not. It has no being of its own, but it is. The isness is the vivarta upadana karana that we call Brahman.
The phrase reminds me, the first one you said, I forget. Reminds me of the phrase, the unmoved mover.
Yeah. Yeah, the unmoved mover. The problem is within the creation, the search for the unmoved mover goes into infinite regress. Right. You can never get there. But the unmoved mover would be Brahman.
Right.
Yeah. The only problem
Aristotle thought the unmoved mover was God, and he thought that God actually didn't know anything about the creation because God was completely unmoved by it. God was only interested in God, which was all it was worth contemplating for God.
That's interesting because it's similar to just the Satchitatma to Brahman, except Brahman's not interested. Brahman just is non-dual being, you know. But what's so beautiful about it is that non-dual me has that incidental attribute that we call Maya. You know, that, and so Maya is like the expression, as the overflow or the expression of Brahman. Because it is Brahman. It doesn't have any other place to be. There's no time or space outside of Maya or outside of the creation, outside of duality. There is no time or space for Maya to be somewhere else. And Maya has no being of its own, so Maya is, you know, Brahman. It is an incidental attribute of Brahman. Incidental means it doesn't bring about any change to Brahman. That's called, actually, in Sanskrit, it's called Tattvastha Lakshana. Tattvastha Lakshana is, if I define something, say I'm trying to show you something, or teach you something, but I don't have any direct way of teaching you that. I have to point to, or showing you that, I have to point to something which differentiates that from everything else, but it's still not that. So the stock example we use is in a Brahmin village, down the row, going down the row, on the road, on both sides, every house is completely identical to the other houses. There isn't the slightest diversity in the houses. They're the same color, the same shape, same everything. They all have chimneys too. All, they're just exactly the same. So how, if I want to show my friend my house, which is down the road quite a ways, it would be hard. I guess we could say, okay, count from here, count down 10 houses on the right, and that's mine. We could show that way. But the Tattvastha Lakshana would be, say, on only my house, there is a crow on top of the chimney. Right? The crow is the Tattvastha Lakshana. Without changing the attributes, the nature of the house in any way, nevertheless, you know, I can identify the self through that. So in a way, this is the test mithya, anything mithya, or the manifestation, sustenance, and resolution of the creation is Tattvastha Lakshana for Brahman. Any nama-rupa, Tattvastha Lakshana for Brahman, because upon analysis, you find that this, whatever it is you're analyzing, becomes mithya, because in every way it goes into infinite regress, infinitely divisible, you know, in terms of an object. Any object can be divided into smaller objects to an infinite regress. Even in terms of time, things come out of time and go. In terms of time, there's bordering by non-existence. And someday we have to go to this chapter 4 of Mandukya Upanishad. We got all the way through the first three chapters, but chapter 4 really goes into these arguments. Kind of hard. Sometimes they're hard to hold in your mind, but once you understand them, they're just astounding. Their whole purpose is to prove that this creation is mithya and that it has no independent being of its own at all. In fact, it has no substance at all. There's no thing there. Yeah.
Sometimes. See, one of the qualities of a creation of mithya is that it has a certain arbitrariness to it. Why is something one way or not the other? And sometimes you can give an answer to it. But sometimes it's just the way everything turned out. It just is this way. And there's something about that isness there that's kind of a... draws you to the fact that it is one way or the other, and there's a reason for it. It kind of draws one's attention. It sort of makes you feel being in a way, or maybe tempts you towards being. At least that's how it seems. You know, so sometimes you walk out in the evening and It's just cool, and the leaves are just moving, and there's just something in the being. And even though what you're looking at is something that's mithya, it's form. It's like something visible. So that's how I understand the metaphor you're using. That the crow, it's what you're looking at is mithya, but somehow it's pointing to something that is being that's not.
That's interesting. Yeah. Especially if you're taking a walk through nature, just the beauty of it, the silence. Your mind resolves into the silence. I found that. But in India, sometimes when I would walk up along the Ganga, it was not crowded. It was just nature and deep, profound silence and beauty with no people around, really. It's just hard to imagine in India. Yeah. But anyway, it was so absorbing. You knew it was so spiritual, or whatever word you want to say. That presence of that divine presence was there. That it's as though the depth of your being came more to the forefront, just because of the silence and beauty of nature. Maybe that's something about what you're talking about. No.
What's the difference at that point between looking for bliss for ease, you know, being free from suffering, sort of on a relative level, versus like actual liberation that's, you know, not about feeling better, not feeling bad?
Well, in the world as individuals, you know, we like to feel better. And there's certain things in the universe and in your life that do make you feel better. And some experiences in the universe or in your life give you an experience of a presence that is divine, or that makes you recognize that there's something bigger than yourself. And you don't have to try, you're not trying necessarily to generate those experiences, but you find yourself in situations where those experiences take place, and it makes you recognize that there's something more here than just this physical world that we're walking around in, you know. And so I'm not talking really right now about trying to generate this experience. I just say that they happen. And one way that they, there's a lot of different things, I suppose, that can generate those deep experiences that make you realize there's something greater than yourself. But one of them, for me, often, even growing up, has been being in nature. And I think that's a common one, actually.
Why do you think that triggers that great beauty, or that kind of...
Because of the beauty and the silence and the beauty and the silence, and just that it exists at all.
You don't want things to be different.
You don't want anything to be different, which gives you that Ishwaratvam.
It's not a dharmic.
It's not a dharmic. It's Jiva Srishti. It's Jiva's it's Ishwara Srishti. It's just pure Ishwara. Not manufactured or changed.
Because it does something to your mind. I mean, you know, that shift is there.
Yeah, because I think your mind doesn't resist it. It embraces it. It loves it. And so you gain a deep shantavritti. You know. There's a lot of beautiful music can do that too. You know, so many things, actually, not just that, but that's a common one. Is when it's just Ishwara Srishti, unadulterated by God's creation, not overrun by what we've done done on top of it. You know, just pure and simple.
The other day you were talking about absolute shanti and relative shanti,
right?
As though shanti had different qualities.
The absolute shanti is the nature of Brahman, of the self, because it never changes. It's absolute. It's free from time. So there's no greater shanti or peace than your own being. You can't go beyond that, because that's absolute. There's nothing to pollute it, nothing to change it, nothing to stain it, nothing to modify it. It just is the very nature of yourself, and it's not objectifiable to be enacted, acted upon in the world. But relative shanti is when your mind enjoys deep peace. You know, because of the situation you find yourself in, or because of contemplation, or because of whatever. Sometimes we don't know why the mind is just so subtle and so peaceful, but that is temporary because the mind is always changing. But we've all had the experience, you know, of a mind that's just enjoying a very deep silence or peacefulness. But it's relative because it's subject to change, where the absolute shanti of the self is just its nature, and it's not bound by time and not subject to change. And that shanti is always present in as the background adhishtana of the ashanti, of the agitation.
So how do you spot that?
Well, that's the viveka. That's the whole thing. That's the whole thing, yeah.
When the mind is in relative ashanti, so agitated, can it recognize absolute shanti?
Yes, once it's known. Once it's known, what you recognize, and which is so much freedom, you can recognize the absolute shanti of your being, which is not covered by the relative ashanti of your mind. In fact, the self, yourself, isn't covered by a vritti, a thought modification that is peaceful, and it's not covered by a thought modification that's, or a thought that's agitated. Neither one cover the self. Just like the thunderstorm doesn't cover the sun, nor does the sunny day. Neither one touches the sun at all.
So the point is for the mind to say, okay, now I'm enjoying absolute shanti, because it's not the one that enjoys it. Consciousness enjoys absolute shanti.
Well, this absolute shanti is always there as your own self. But the mind, when you say the mind, oh, my mind is so peaceful, it's so quiet, it's so subtle, or whatever I'm going to say, you know, you're talking about the quality of a vritti in the mind, a thought modification. It's a quiet, peaceful thought. So you say, oh, my mind is so peaceful, it has so much shanti right now, it has so much peace. That's just a state of mind. The shanti of the self is not a state, it's the very nature. So the self can't all of a sudden become agitated, whereas the mind that's enjoying shanti can become agitated, it can become sorrowful, it can change its mood for who knows what reasons. So it's only a limited time-bound experience, a possible experience, you know, but time-bound.
Yeah.
What actually gives maybe perhaps the most shanti, the most long-lasting shanti of the mind is the commitment to Dharma. That commitment to Dharma is very rewarding. Not just the commitment, but I mean the staying within Dharma is keeps the mind in a naturally very peace, a natural shanti. No problems come up and all of that, but the mind itself enjoys a long-lasting shanti as long as you're acting within Dharma. And when Dharma is your nishtha, that's really your commitment first before anything else, then the mind enjoys a great deal of peace. And that's what the Vedas are always teaching, the Karmakanda, the importance of Dharma for any type of longevity in terms of peace. Whereas if your mind is committed to just fulfilling your desires and positively and negatively, let me have this, let me have that so I can be happy, and let me get rid of this and let me get rid of that so I can be happy, that commitment is more difficult because you don't really have any control over it. You may or may not be able to fulfill your desires. You know, it's not like you're in control of everything. You know, there's too many obstacles that can really stop you from getting what you want. But with Dharma, you have control over that. It's an attitude, it's a commitment, you know, in terms of the way you respond to the world. And so it gives you much It's much longer lasting. You have much more shanti with that. And also the, you know, like the values, Swamiji's value of values, the commitment to those values is more important than your raga dvesha, your likes and dislikes. It's just more important. That's what you're doing. That's what you like to do. You like to grow in those values. You like to grow in Dharma. Because you've, and this is just within the relative world, because you've experienced which one gives the most happiness. It's all very selfish. But not, we don't really call that selfish. It's wise, actually. It means I've assimilated my experience to know, you know, what makes me really deeply at home with myself, or deeply at peace, and what it actually creates a lot of agitation.
Less conflict in the mind.
Much less conflict in the mind.
Well, that in itself produces a silence. Then, I mean,
it does, relative silence, because the instant you're adharmic, then it'll be agitated. Or when the raga dvesha, the likes and dislikes pop up, then agitation and worry naturally come with that. That's why you learn about this karma yoga, that attitude, you know, of binding or non-binding desire. You can have non-binding desires where you honor the desire, but if I don't get my way, that's fine. You know, I have a different kind of attitude based upon my knowledge. Then I'm free to have the desires, and it's all right if it doesn't work out. I kind of accept all of the results of my actions as prasad. Then that's okay, because what's more important to me is that prasada buddhi than the actual fulfillment of the desire.
Karen, so is it, and I don't know if I'm not understanding the definition or whatever clearly, but yeah. So is it not a desire to have the mind rest in the self? Like, I definitely, I want that.
You know what they say? They say, that's right. That is a strong desire.
Yeah.
And it creates agitation and worry, just like all desires do. But what they say is, but it's a benign desire, because the fulfillment of that desire wipes out all of problems.
And then prejudice, yeah. Too. I keep floating around and with it in my head. It's like, well, but that doesn't even matter, because you are the self.
You are the self, but the mind still has a desire to know it. And that desire can cause a lot of agitation and pain, they say, but it's a benign desire, because at least when you fulfill the desire, then all the other desires drop off or become mitya. So you have to go through the torturous desire, you know, because it can be the desire of a mumukshu is a very, very strong desire. Mm-hmm. They even say, they use an example of like somebody who's sitting near a lake whose hair is caught on fire. They're sitting around a bonfire. They have this matted hair, jidda, you know, and a spark goes and lights their head up. So and then they look over at the lake and they think, should I go in the lake? They don't think that. They're off and running to get into the lake, you know. And so once a person gains that mumukshutvam, then it's a strong desire to fulfill it. And
it's a binding desire.
It's a binding desire.
But it's okay.
But you can feel this is a good binding desire, because it's one that solves the whole problem of desire. After that, the desires become mitya, because you found the source of the ananda, the happiness you're seeking. That's why. It's like the what you're seeking is hidden in the seeker. And that's the discovery.
So then, and I don't know if this is just my little jiva, and I really don't want to come back to this place, but so the time of my death, and I'm like, but I haven't found myself, or my mind hasn't rested in myself yet.
Arjuna was so afraid of that. Because Krishna was teaching him, but they were in the middle of the battlefield and he was going to have to go back to war, and so he's thinking,
yeah.
You know, you've told me all this and it's clear now, but once I get in the middle of the battlefield, I'm sure that I'm going to lose it. I haven't had enough time. So what will happen to me? I haven't gotten it yet, and I don't have enough time, you know? And so Krishna said, you will never be an Ubhayabhrashta. This is in the Bhagavad Gita. Ubhayabhrashta means you've become a mumukshu. You've kind of left samsara. It has no meaning for you anymore. You know, you've seen through it now, which Arjuna did. And so that's not going to work for you. But you didn't get knowledge either. And so then you're just hanging here in the middle with nothing. You die and you don't have knowledge and you're finished with samsara. That's called ubhaya. Both sides. Ubhaya means both sides, you know, this one and this side. Brashta. You've lost both sides.
Mm. Yes.
And so that was his fear. Mm. That Krishna kind of heard in his questioning. So he said, you will never be an Ubhayabhrashta. You will either be, based on your karma, born immediately into a family of jnanis, or you will exhaust some karma that needs to be exhausted, and then you will hook up with with a teacher again. So you never, once you cross over into the mumukshutvam, you can't go back. And you can't attract karmas that have anything to do with the samsari. You don't have those karmas. The karmas are all for gaining knowledge, even though you may have some people have some initially. I certainly did, about 23 years of them, initial karmas. But they do say that, and this is also true, I think, for most people, you also see you're born into a good family, you know, even if they're kind of... You're born into a good enough family.
Good enough.
Good enough family. Born into a good enough family. And then at the right time you hook back up with your teacher. With a teacher. That's the promise. So either you're born into a family of jnanis and you pick up the thread immediately, or you pick up the thread later on. If you're somebody like Arjuna, who was right in the middle of this teaching, and he wasn't allowed to... He was worried he wasn't able, wouldn't be able to hold that knowledge in this intense situation.
Well, aren't you talking about the maturing of that knowledge? I mean, don't you need some time for that?
You need some time, not just the 2 hours right before you're going to go to war, and then be killed in battle. Then, you know, he was just concerned about it. Mm. Now, say you've never had any teaching. You don't die unfulfilled. You know, you just haven't had any teaching. At some point, that mumukshutvam dawns, and then you meet a teacher. And then that knowledge, if you have enough time in this life, it's not that you're supposed to take birth after birth after birth, but what if you come to this teaching and you only have a few years and it's not complete in you? Your mind hasn't matured enough into it. Then you'll just pick up the thread in your next birth. It's actually just quite simple, and if you think about the laws of karma, that makes sense that it would be that way, because the force, the inclination of your mind is no longer really towards samsara. It's not that you don't do things in samsara, have desires in samsara, but that's not your major focus. Your major focus is knowledge, and you can't change that. You can't make the desires of samsara into your major focus. It won't happen, because you already know the limitations of that. So the knowledge itself has to be completed, and then you can live out your prarabdha, which can be anything. You can get married and have kids, or you can whatever life brings. Some people are married and have children. Some people are single all of their lives. Some people go into religious order.
How did it turn out for Arjuna?
Well, the war was pretty deadly, you know, and everybody was slaughtered in the war. And then all of them took a hike up to heaven, and Bhagavan let them in. So that question, we know that at the end of the Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna understood. And he had questions all the way through those 18 chapters. At the end, he was clear. And so just a he was, so we know that at the end he was clear. And he had asked in the middle of it, what will happen to me if I'm killed in the battle? He wasn't killed in the battle. But almost everybody was killed. The Bhagavad Gita takes place in the middle of the 18 or more volumes of the Mahabharata. It's 18 chapters, but I think there's 18 or 20, something like that. Big volumes. It's like this. Right in the middle of it is this little Bhagavad Gita. Right? And so there was a lot going on. A lot of it was about the war and how everybody was slaughtered and all of the rules of war and all the different family situations. And then what happened when there was really just a handful of people left. And then it goes down their trek up to the gates of, you know,
Swarga.
Mm-hmm. And then, I don't remember, I'll have to reread this, which I would enjoy actually rereading the whole thing again. So I like really long books. Because once you, I like it to be really long, because once you get in it, then you can just live in that book for a while. Okay. I like them to be like 1,000, 800,000 pages. Those are really great books because you just... So the Mahabharata is like thousands of pages. And so once you're in, it's really wonderful. It takes a while to get in, though, because the names are so long and complex. And it uses a little, if you're reading it in English, it's kind of old English. You know? It takes a while to get into it, but you do get into it. And it's so rich. So anyway, there's a story at the very end where Yudhishthira, who is the oldest of the five Pandavas, Arjuna was in the middle somewhere, Yudhishthira had a dog who is loyal, his loyal companion, that always liked little Shweta, you know. Always trotting along by your side. You know, so Yudhishthira had his dog that was always with him, and he got to the gates where Yama, or whoever it was to let him in, but was not going to let his dog in. And so he said, I won't come in without my dog. So I won't come in without my dog. And so that was one test. Because his dog had been so loyal to him, you know, and he wouldn't leave him behind. The other thing was, he was heard, his four other brothers wailing and in misery as though they didn't make it to Swarga heaven. They were down there in hell for whatever reason. And they were moaning and groaning and screaming and crying. And he was listening to all of their wailing and their groaning and their hurting. And he said, I would rather be with my brothers. I would rather be with my brothers than be in Swarga Loka without them. So he passed the test. And then all of the brothers and everybody went to Swarga. Believe me, I don't tell the story as good as it is. The stories are really, it's really good. That end part, that's just the little bit I know, remember of it. It was kind of a gruesome ending in a way. Yeah. But you learn a lot in reading that book. If you read these, what do you call them? Abridged books, like the whole Mahabharata in 300 pages. You know, it's not good. They take out of it all of the things that are meaningful and just leave the action story. Everything else is removed. And actually in the Mahabharata there are, I don't know, hundreds and hundreds of stories. But they're not there woven in and out of the main, you know, action story. So all of those have to be taken out because it would be, you know, 4,000 or 5,000 pages or however long it is. It's long. So they take out all of the things that are so amazing. So you should just, you know, when you feel like it, sit down and begin the
6 months.
Yeah. Nighttime reading. Mm-hmm. Do you know that grandmas in India, they always tell their children the stories, all the Mahabharata. They'll just, every night, they'll go in there to be with their grandkids and tell them all these stories. And Kiki's mother, you know Kiki, her mother when her mother comes to visit, she'll come and visit for 1 or 2 months. Every night she tells Arjuna, Arjuna is her Kiki's son, all of these stories.
Huh.
Yeah, it's this tradition. I think it's beautiful. Yeah. So, let me answer a couple of questions online here. Let me get too frustrated. Annalisa says the trees are moving west. Did you know that?
I know that. I thought about that.
Yeah, and there is a website in the Atlantic. Let me just.
It was an IFL article that I saw.
It's in the Atlantic. I'm actually bringing it up so that we have it.
Is it in California at least?
No, but the trees are like migrating species of trees that used
walking.
To be in one area of the United States are moving.
Are moving west.
Yeah, like some of them are moving up towards New York, like that way, and some of them are moving out towards the west. Did you read it, Joey? Yeah.
American trees are moving west, and no one knows why. Mm-hmm. It's in the Atlantic. Anyway, I've got this article for us. I can send it to you.
It's happening in Antarctica now. There's a lot more green plants and mosses in Antarctica where there weren't any.
Yeah, because of the warmth.
Yeah,
that's what it's about. The trees are following their climate so that they can survive.
Mm-hmm. And the coral reef around Australia, it started to die in the north, but it's starting to move south towards the Antarctica.
Oh.
It actually says in the Vedas that the trees get smaller and the people get smaller. Yes. According to Swamiji, I haven't read the whole Kali Purana, but these are a few things that he said that
like
says.
I'll tell you a couple of things.
You're a precursor. Let me answer this question. What is the distinction between desires and needs in Dharma? It's that your desires and needs should always be within Dharma. If they're outside of Dharma, then it's better to follow Dharma than what you think is a need. Needs aren't a dharmic. If you view it as a dharmic, if you think that it's a need and then you say it's a dharmic, then I would kind of redefine it as not really a need. It's what you think is a need. So Dharma comes first, and then desires and needs should be fulfilled within Dharma. So a need is really in Dharma. It depends on what the need is. That's what you have to desire. If you think that you really need something and it's a dharmic, then you might have to reconsider.
We were at school, the need was sort of really sort of for food, water, shelter.
Food, water, and shelter.
And iPad.
Hi, Susan. So nice to see you. Hey, Susan, it's so nice to see you online. I haven't seen you for so long. And congratulations on your little babies. Why don't you send me a picture? Yes,
Susan. Dogs or cats?
Maxwell. Well, that's interesting. Maybe so. So Annalisa says, so that means it isn't a need but a desire if it is a dharma. Well, maybe that may be true, because I can't see something that's an actual need. in reality being a dharmic, I think you'd have to kind of rewrite the need. You know? It's like I have a real need to be a dharmic. No, I don't think so. You're welcome. What timer?
Is Danya online?
Huh?
Is Danya online?
No. She usually is, but I don't know what she's doing. Maybe you should call her and see how she's doing. Or I will.
I was just going to text
her or something, yeah. She knows we're on. Fine.
Her salad was a big hit.
Yeah.
It was. That was a delicious salad.
No, that's not that.
Oh, that one. That was good too. I love the salad we had today, though.
Mm.
I liked that last night also, of course. It was really good.
Is there any of that?
The quinoa salad? No?
Sounds good.
It was good. Yeah, send me some pics, Susan. Oh, yes. Bring her to the farm. That would be great. Send me some pictures. In fact, if you send them right now, I can show everybody. That would be so nice.
Is there any more questions?
Mm-hmm. No, you have one?
Yeah, sort of about being possessive about the self, like as a way of I am water more than other things. Like, I think you said today that you could say I am that, but you could also say it is or you are or something like that. Mm.
I was talking about language. So that isness, the word, the verbal root is to be. For I am, you are, it is. Those are just words for existence, for being. Like, I am doing this, you are doing that, it is. You know, when you conjugate a verb. But all of those are just different words for being. So if I say, Swamiji would say like this, I say, I am you, you are, and the wall is. That's confusing because we have three words, and so the words themselves divide everything up. So you could just say, you know, I am, you am, it am, or I are, you are, it are. Just to realize we're talking about one non-dual existence that all beings enjoy. And so it's that the language divides it up as though the existence is objectified in some way, but it's not. It's not objectified at all. But it's super, the being, the isness, the amness that you enjoy. Take for granted, actually, I am, I'm a conscious being. Everybody says that about themselves, but that amness is not something that can be objectified into a subject-object relationship like everything else in the universe. Everything else is, you're able to objectify it and have a subject-object relationship with it. If it comes within your sphere. The sphere is your means of knowledge that you have available to you. It can be objectified. Even your mind, your emotions, your imaginations, your intellections, your memories, your sense of the condition of your sense organs. Everything is objectifiable. Everything you've taken to be yourself is actually objectifiable to a subject-object relationship. But who you actually are is not objectifiable, because who's going to objectify it? And who you actually are is kind of the bottom line in terms of your experience, is just conscious being. And that can't be objectified, and there's nothing behind it to objectify it. And then you would have to bring in consciousness to objectify consciousness, which doesn't make any sense.
Well, that gives a different definition to existence, because usually you think the object produces existence.
Well, yeah, it's like just a word that hangs off the object that has very little meaning. It's like, that is. Okay. The cup is. It's also, the cup is, all you're doing is using isness as for in language. You're not recognizing. You, existence, is, it doesn't mean anything. If you say the cup is, it's just that here's the cup. The cup exists here in the world. So the cup is. Yeah, but you're really only talking about the cup. You're not talking about any being that it has, or that the is that the existence is the noun and the cup is the adjective. You know.
So M, is, and R are exactly the same thing.
Yeah, and all are non-objectifiable. Exactly. You have no. There are only one non-dual conscious being. Exactly.
Hmm? That's
being.
A big deal.
Being.
Yeah, it's a big deal.
It's
being, isn't
it?
Being, yeah.
Being
is consciousness, though. And consciousness is being. They're not two separate things. It's not like being is a substantive that has consciousness as an adjective, or that consciousness is the substantive that has being as an adjective. It's that they're both two words that are talking about one thing. Mm. That is consciousness, which is being, and being, which is consciousness. I don't want Marjorie to fall.
I know.
Okay. Hi, Marjorie.
She was out too long. She looked outside too long. She said she got in the zone.
Yeah.
She needs to make sure there's plenty of.
Marjorie and I have a pact that whenever she dozes off, I'm supposed to poke her. If I doze, she pokes me.
A long stick.
Yeah.
A broom.
Oh, Carol, can I just say something not related to class?
Sure.
Just the heat and make sure everybody drink plenty of the
water.
Plenty of the electrolyte water and water in general. My experience with just skincare business and just staying hydrated, take your weight, divide it in half. That's how many ounces you kind of want to shoot for drinking water-wise. But then especially if you're out doing yard work like Margie was all day, like, you know, and everybody has been, you're sweating, so you'll need even more. So especially like if everybody's going to be out again tomorrow, the next couple of days.
Well, that's
water.
A lot of ounces. I don't have to drink.
It is a lot of water, and yes, you will be using the bathroom a lot, mm-hmm. but you don't want to get heat stroke. You don't want to get dehydrated. If you are thirsty, you are already dehydrated. So, just kind of a weather.
Yeah. I'm really thirsty. I want more water.
Yeah. Just kind of. That Berkey that's outside. Is that the metal thing? Mm-hmm. The metal thing. I've been trying to fill that out. But you can fill at the bottom. And then you can fill at the top. I'm finding that people are drinking it through faster than it'll flood or something. But we can keep that one.
We can top that up with the half water, can't we?
Yeah, that's what the thing has in.
Okay. Yeah, that, and that tap out there, you know, the hose that's right on the porch, that's drinking water.
Okay.
And out here, too, there's a faucet that's drinking water. Anything that's attached to the house. And also by my room, by the door to the bathroom, that is drinking water. Any faucet that's attached to the house is coming from our well. So that's kind of nice to know also.
Yeah, and if you get too hot, like, just get the hose and, like, the back of your neck and your scalp, just kind of get yourself to cool down immediately. Yes, I've had too much heat before, so...
Rather also needs to get more heat in the summer. So, geez, we know.
Really?
Yes, normally you get usually overheated working out in the fields and.
And then what would happen to me? See, I've totally forgotten about it.
And then the classes would have to get canceled because.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. I would get sunstroke.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
And I could not give the class. I couldn't even get up.
Yeah.
Yeah. I forgot. I used to get sunstroke working too long outside because it was hot.
Yeah.
And then I'd come in, it'd be time to give the class, and I realized I was totally wiped, so wiped out I couldn't even... No, I couldn't even get on the internet to tell everybody. I think Jackie or somebody got on and said... I was just... forgot all about that. Thank you for reminding me. And it happened I don't know, two or three times.
Mm. Oh, so you weren't wearing a hat? Was that the reason?
No,
it's just out there too long. It gets really hot.
Yeah. And not enough water.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Are you listening, Marjorie? You need to drink a lot of water.
Yeah, more than I did.
More than you did.
About half as much as I should today.
Yeah.
But it hasn't been that hot.
Yeah, but now it's going to be hotter.
Get that way.
Now.
Marjorie. Come on.
Oh, gosh.
Water, but you can't make him drink.
That's right.
I'm tired.
Oh, me too. Oh. In one big happy family again.
There is that outdoor shower too.
Yes, actually, that's
a good one just to hose down.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Does anybody want one?
I do.
No, there is one. We put something. There's one tap that sort of is connected to the solar heater.
One's hot, one's cold, right?
And at one stage it was written sort of hot and cold on it, but I think that's sort of faded. So
okay.
Some sort of permanent marker, maybe I can do that again.
Yeah, that would be great. There's a permanent marker.
Okay. But when Phoebe came over here, she thought, "Oh, this is solid hot water."
Yeah.
So she started to have a shower,
yeah.
And she didn't realize that was so. But she said, "I said, how did you do it?" She said, "I just wet my head with the under my arm." Very brave.
I could see her liking that.
Yeah.
Is there some kind of balance about having a nice, lovely time and being disciplined and uptight about, oh, I need to be more dharmic and, you know, plumb the depths and all this?
But having a nice, lovely time is fine unless there's something dharmic about it. When you get to have a nice, lovely time, I would just enjoy it.
Mm. I just mean, like, I'm being ambitious. There's, I guess, loveliness in that, too, at the right time.
Usually that doesn't come up.
Yeah. I apply my Western ambitious zeal.
That's great. That is Western. It is. We need to do that. Yeah. We're in a hurry.
That's one thing that I think it was last night you were talking about, just being with however long it takes for the knowledge to come, you know, just kind of let it run its own course. It's kind of nice to,
to move with it.
Yeah.
We have to, in the end, we have to slow down to Ishwara's time. Mm. That makes life so nice. And then you have your imagination as a gift, as a tool. You know, the imagination can really get out of control. Where it's, you know, instead of using it as a tool, as a creative tool that can really help you, we worry, you know, we imagine into the future and then experience the, like say if you have kind of catastrophic thinking, you're actually imagining disastrous things happening in the future and then you're feeding the emotions of that, you know, instead of really learning how to be fully present with what's here and do what needs to be done, the decisions that have to be made now, that's really wonderful. There's not very many problems that come up when it's like that. Most of the problems are projections into the future, projected worries into the future. And so you slowly get in the habit of not doing that and just kind of living in Ishwara's time. And then that's not that you don't make decisions or do things, but you do things and make decisions that are relevant to do and make right now, even for the future. You know what I mean? Because you can project way into the future and you're not anywhere near ready to make any kind of decisions or actions on that. But you can see it coming, and yet it's not time to, it's not the right time to make those moves yet. But then there can be a lot of worry and stress. What's going to happen?
She mentioned to allow the flower bud to bloom.
Yeah. Flowers. And even like a place like this farm, it's unfolding nicely. It's doing nicely, but if you look into the future, and, well, when am I going to be able to get this? And when am I going to be able to get that? When I'm not even close to getting any of those things, maybe I'll never get those things. I have no idea. But the farm has a life of its own, and it's moving right along, and I think it's doing just great.
So beautiful.
Yeah, but you know, you can project ideas, and then how are you going to fulfill those ideas? That used to happen to Swamiji all the time with his ashram. How are you going to pay for this? Swamiji, how are you going to pay for this? And if you're going to get that hall, you can't pay for it, so you don't have enough money to do that. That's just because it's fear. But if you just let the thing live, you know, it has a life of its own, and you just tend it and pay attention to it, you know, and do what you can. We've done a huge amount of stuff these last 3 years, but we're not in a hurry. We just keep doing, and things keep improving and becoming nicer and nicer and nicer.
Didn't you say something like, if we can't pay for it, they'll leave or something?
No, Swamiji said people were always worrying about money, and we won't be able to do this, and you can't build that, so we can't afford this. Swamiji said, how are we going to manage? And Swamiji just said something with a little sharpness. It's hard for Swamiji to have sharpness in his voice. It's not, he's not really like that. But he said something like, you know, if it needs to close down, if Bhagavan doesn't support it, then I'll just go back to Rishikesh. It's no problem at all. He got up and went upstairs. and then everyone said, no, Swamiji, no, we didn't mean anything.
But also, those things are still being said. Those things are still being said the years before. That people are still worried.
Yeah.
Because it was always, it was relative to what was happening.
Yeah.
You know, so there was always the same.
Yeah, always worry.
About the next thing.
Yeah.
What, you know, where are we going to put the boys' door? Where are the,
And one good friend. One good friend of mine there who's in, did a lot of the construction, he was a worrier. And it just used to drive him crazy that we were going ahead and building when there wasn't enough money in the bank. Mm-hmm. And for Swamiji, it was like, we'll get the money. It'll come, don't worry. You know? And so there was a...
And then what happened?
You know, money always came.
And the worry guy?
He always worried.
What is that saying? Worrying is like sitting in a rocking chair and gets you nowhere.
Well, Swamiji used to say, if something is meant to happen, it's going to happen. It doesn't matter how much we try not to make it happen.
And
if it's not meant to happen, it's not going to happen no matter how much we try to make it happen.
Yes, don't worry. It's good. It's nice, too. It's nice we have Swamiji in our life. He keeps coming up in our... All the stories about him. There's always a place for another story.
It's always with us.
Should we say a prayer? Okay, Susan sent us some pictures. As soon as we say our prayer, we're going to look at those pictures of your baby. Om Swasti Prajaya Paripalayantam Nyayena Margena Mahimahishaha
Brahmane Vyashivamastu Nityam Loka Samasta Sukhino Bhavantu Kale Varshatu Parjanyaha Prithivi Sasya Shalini Desho Yam Shobharitaha Brahmana Santu Nirbhayaha Om Sarve Bhavantu Sukhinaha Sarve Santu Niramayaha Sarve Bhadrani Pashyantu Ma Kashchit Dukha Bhagavet Asato Ma Sagamaya Tamaso Ma Jyotirgamaya Mrityorma Amritangamaya Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Rupyo Namaha Hari Om